Hi again. Welcome back to our third episode of Three Sides to Every Adoption. I'm Sarah Easterly. I'm an adoptee, and I'm joined by Kelsey Vandervliet Ranyard, who's a birth mom, and Lori Holden, who's an adoptive mom. Welcome.
Hi, everyone.
Hi.
Hi, hi. All right. Well, today we wanted to talk about adoption and mental health, emotional health, mental and emotional health, however we want to say it. A pretty large topic, we realized. So we were just kind of having a little pregame here before chatting, and we're going to squeeze in a lot, and we may end up tackling whatever may come out of this or what comments that you all share with us in future conversations that we have. But we thought we'd just start broad and talk about something that came up this week. And it's interesting because we were already planning on this topic, and then it was tossed around as our next topic to talk about. And then we happened to see out kind of circulating around Adoption Land an article that kind of affirmed that, okay, yes, let's talk about this. And in the article, it was an advice column in a national publication, and it was a parent, an adoptive parent, who mentioned that she was struggling with her son, who had some anger, and he was an adult son, and she was looking for help. The therapist who replied with feedback essentially didn't mention much about adoption, just kind of focused in on the anger, focused in on the ADHD and some enabling, which was pretty frustrating for adoptees watching. I will say that I saw a lot of that, and I was frustrated as well. And what kind of made me nod along, though, because we were just talking about how so often in therapeutic circles and other circles, adoption for adoptees gets missed. Or if we are forthright in sharing that we're adopted as adults when we go into therapy, it gets brushed aside. It symptoms tend to be easier to look at than the underlying causes. And so anyway, I thought I'd just start with that article. That's my kind of high level reaction. And Kelsey and Lori, I'd love to hear your reactions to it too.
Lori, do you want to go first?
Yeah, I kind of see this as a byproduct, a very predictable byproduct of what we grew up with in our adoption policies, which is adoption is no big deal. Just love them. Just raise them as if they're your own. You know, if you are placing a baby, just move on, forget about it, and go live your life. And so when we minimize something that's really big for all three parts of the adoption triad, it's no wonder that professionals will end up being gobsmacked to find out that maybe adoption does lead to some issues.
I think for me, when I hear these kind of things, which I do pretty often, I think I get confused of what is it about adoption that is such a threat to like the public and society. Like, what is it about my adoption experience that makes you hesitate to attribute anything, any kind of trauma to it? Does that make sense? Like, it's kind of, I know it's, I've heard from many adoptees, like it's hurtful to, they want to, you know, talk about every other life event except the adoption. We can't possibly talk down about the adoption. And it's not necessarily talking down, it's just, you know, being reckoning with reality and the trauma and loss and adoption and how that may affect our mental health and emotional health later on in life or early in life. And I just think we just do such a disservice when we neglect that side. If we want our kids to be whole, individual, healthy human beings that grow up into healthy adults, I think we have to look at all sides, and that includes looking at adoption.
Yeah. I'm reflecting on a couple of things you just said there, Kelsey, and kind of overlaying it with my experience. So I struggled with my mental health starting in adolescence on. My parents did take me to a therapist when I was a teenager after a suicide attempt. And there was very little spoken in the therapeutic setting about adoption. I talked about wondering about my birth mom a lot. And I don't know if it's, I don't know. There's a few things. I guess I have my own kind of biases and theories of when you were saying, you know, why. I think, is there a discomfort around adoption? Is there discomfort of not knowing, not having that lived experience if the therapists don't have any experience? I don't think it's covered very much still in school, when they're getting their training, which is why so many adoptees are becoming therapists now, which is wonderful, to kind of fill that hole and to start that education and the studies. So I think it's that, I don't know if just bad information of not, I don't know, it's interesting, but, and or the tendency to pathologize, which is not helpful. I think, it's so easy to look at symptoms like this therapist did, and I felt like that was what resulted in my therapy in adolescence and through adulthood. What's frustrating is, that for most of the adoptees I know, we didn't get therapy or the support we needed in our childhood. And it's up to us as adults. So we have to figure it out. And we, in a lot of cases, and this came up in the comments on that article, we have to be the ones educating our therapists and telling them, and not everybody can do that. If you're stuck, you may not yourself put that link together that this could be relinquishment adoption related. So, and of course there's the privilege of being able to do that because not everyone has the healthcare or the coverage or the financial ability to pay for therapy. So it's really a big one for adoptees. It's just, there's a whole bunch to say about that. And the pathologizing, when ultimately I think, what it comes down to is grief. Adoption is not possible without loss. And so there is so much to grieve, so much loss. And that goes for all of us. But I'm going to share the adoptee's point of view. And so, even if it's not therapy, why are we so afraid? Is it culturally? Are we afraid of looking at grief? I know there's that too. And there's so much messaging everywhere about be happy. And is it this flight from looking honestly at pain that contributes to some of that too? I don't know.
Yeah, let me talk about this a little bit from the from my point of view. Because adoptive parents are often the ones who can get help or not get help. And by coming to that decision that help is needed, even if it's just more like support. So two of the factors with that is one, and I know we'll probably cover this on a future episode, but a lot of adoptive parents come to the well, I want to back up for a second. I'm about to interview a podcast guest. And what she said in a talk that I saw her give is that everyone comes to adoption on their knees. And I love that because it acknowledges the brokenness that everybody comes to it with. Now, maybe not all adoptive, you could probably not all this a lot, but especially for the ones who come through infertility, I think we can say that from all three of our viewpoints, we come to this in a state of brokenness. So adoptive parents have the next step, which is after through infertility, you've been told you can't have children, you're not good enough, but you can adopt and you have to show how you're super good. You have to like super qualify in all the measures, then to actually hit the ground running in parenting. And be able to say, hey, this is harder than we thought. We're up against things we didn't understand and we're going to get help. That's a huge hurdle. And it takes some emotional intelligence for parents to say, we need help, whatever that looks like for either them or their child. The other thing that I think adoptive parents go through is people don't want to cause that trauma or like make it bigger than it is. I think you kind of alluded to that, Sarah, by like saying, hey, you're adopted, you need therapy. So there's this delicate dance we do between denying adoption and its effects on our child and dwelling on it. You don't want to make it bigger than it is, but you also don't want to make it smaller than it is. And that's a tough thing to know, when is that time to get help? And then that's a huge ordeal, because how do you get help? How do you get good help? So that's a whole other Oprah.
That's a really good point. And it may not always be therapy, right? Like, it may be a community of other adoptive parents with adoptees. I'm thinking of Adoption Mosaic and all of the wonderful programming that they have along that line. So you get really solid parenting informed by adoptees' perspectives.
And things also like camps, adoption camps, where maybe the whole benefit of that is that your children are hanging out with other kids who have that common experience. And then maybe they build relationships and start talking with each other about it, facilitated often by teen adoptees or adult adoptees.
Right. Heritage camps comes to mind near you. Yes. And it could be just lots of, I mean, I'm a big believer in just lots of space for grieving and for walking, making an invitation for the grief. Adoptees may not be ready for a long time. It's really, you know, it's like, you know, very harsh to look at it too close. And so it may not be possible, but you still can create that invitation through lots of, like, I'm back to picture books, but picture books are a fantastic way to just have sad feelings. They don't even have to be about adoption. Not some of those adoption books are too direct and too kind of poking into what Dr. Gordon Neufeld at the Neufeld Institute says, poking at the wound, you know, poking at the bruise, the tender spot. So it doesn't even need to be about adoption, just books that make room for grieving and for sadness and show that you as a parent are comfortable with grief. Yeah, I'm thinking of other things, just not always therapy. Laura, you mentioned the camps and the support groups. I'm also thinking just good old play, like playing around, playing around it as well. You know, it doesn't have to be just an intent to get your child crying, but playing can be so important too.
And back to the original point too, is just cluing in social workers, educators, therapists, anybody who works with kids, people in the child welfare system, anybody who's having contact with kids, that adoption is a piece of it. And if you're ignoring it completely, you're missing probably the underlying piece of all the other stuff that you're seeing. I think that's kind of what you were saying at the very beginning.
Yeah. And I wanted to share something that came up for me yesterday. I signed up for a yoga for trauma, trauma survivors. I can't remember the exact title, but it was yoga and trauma. And based on Stephen Porges's work on the polyvagal nervous system and how that all goes together. And it was excellent. I will say it was fantastic. I'm really glad that I'm signed up for this. And there were just here and there comments made that kind of to go back to that time before your trauma. And so again, I just sat there as the adoptee going, I didn't have a time before trauma. So do I A, go try to educate the yoga instructor? Do I B, sit there feeling like I'm not, you know, I'm going to say I did all of these, you know, I have, you know, A, B, do I sit there feeling like I'm an imposter and I'm not qualified to be in this room with these other people who've had trauma? And then I start doing the comparison of whose trauma is worse. And I don't even know the other people's situations, but in my head, I was deciding mine didn't matter. Or C, is it getting upset because mine matters more? I don't have that foundation to turn back to that that other people have. And again, like, I think we've talked about this before, comparing traumas is not useful, but it just reminded me that there's just education needed, because I think it's still, believe it or not, it's still not always recognized that adoption equals trauma.
Yeah, and I think that exists in a lot of corners of adoption too, because I hear from a lot of birth moms that maybe went back to the hospital they delivered at, and then we're looking for like almost like bereavement therapy or help, and they're like, well, that's not what happened to you, so no. And so we don't like fit in a box, you know. So we're kind of an other. So
I'm playing it out in my head, Sarah, at your yoga class yesterday. If you were to explain to people, this was my trauma, I can't go back to before it, I think that would have been it would take a lot of explanation, because of how the prevailing attitude of adoption is that it was nothing, and that you're alive and you should be grateful, and you had a good life, obviously had a good life. So how can there be trauma when, you know, adoption has happened to you and it was a good thing?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. That would have taken a lot of education.
Yeah. And I didn't do the education, and I thought about, you know, do I speak off, you know, offline to the instructor? And at some point I probably will, but yeah, it wasn't worth taking up time, because you have to decide when is it worth, when right. is it useful and when is it not.
Right. But not only the instructor, but the other people in the class, you would have blown their minds, because I think for the most part, we don't think about adoption in that level of complexity. It's a very simple thing. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. You got a new life, you should be grateful.
Yeah. And one thing you just reminded me of, Lori, and I want to come back to what you just said to Kelsey as well, just about birth parents and bereavement and grieving. So I just want to flag that so we don't forget. But one thing I also wanted to add on about adoptees and mental health is, in our youth, a lot of us look really good. And so I think it's very easy for everybody to just kind of make that leap to, oh, well, not my child. I think we lucked out. We're doing it right. Or this isn't affecting my child. Or adoptees who kind of say, oh, as I did for many years, I'm fine. I'm really glad I was adopted. You know, defensive. There are defenses that we erect, but they can look really good and kind of almost take parents off the hook in a way. So,
do you mean in terms of like overachieving and appearing to have it all together?
Having it all together, I'll say the things, because all adoptees are different. I always want to make that point. But for me, it was perfectionism, definitely overachieving. I was very, very organized, very detailed, very, you know, things that aren't necessarily bad, but a lot of it was stemming from just kind of a neurotic need to make order and create order out of this chaotic environment that I started in, right? And just kind of this, my brain needing to organize and sort it through the chaos. Perfectionism, just a lot of, and the denial, the outright denial. And that was believable. I made myself believe it as much as I made everyone around me believe it.
And before we switch back to Kelsey's topic, I want to bring up too, Sarah, you wrote an article on this that's been pretty impactful on me. And I think it was called Not My Adoptee, or Trauma Looks Good on You. So people can Google that and Sarah Easterly and find more about that from you.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
Sarah, I wanted to ask you a question, because, and this has been formulated in my brain in the past 30 seconds, so bear with me here. But I, just from what we know about grief in general, the sooner you start, the sooner you get through, because it, and it is a cycle, but to get to the major milestones of acceptance and understanding, to delay that is to let it fester, and it can create problems down the road. And I just wanted to ask you, do you think that you know, allowing your child the space and working towards mental and emotional health and well-being for your adoptee early on as a child, allowing them that space to grieve, I guess, early, prevents them from getting into an adulthood utterly confused. And it doesn't take away those feelings, but do you think that it lessens to any degree or makes things easier for them?
I mean, my belief is absolutely, why wouldn't it? But I think, you know, we still don't have enough adoptees speaking out kind of from, I am inspired. I think a lot of adoptive parents are really working on this and hearing adoptees listening to us and working for the better for adoptees' emotional and mental health in this regard. So, but they need to grow up. Those kids need to grow up and share. But I don't know how it couldn't go well. You know, I mean, you're making space. And I think, you know, every once in a while I have a little niggle. You know, I think you can't force people or children, anyone really, this is humans, but you can't force people to look at something they're not ready to look at. So I think that's the one caution I would have that I could see down the road for the young adoptees now when they're adults looking back and feeling like all they did was shove adoption and grief down my throat. Like that could be hard too. So you have to read the cues. It's
formula.
You have to know your child and walk along them and come alongside quietly and gently and drop those hints and invitations in gentle ways. So I think making that space and how could it not be helpful?
I do kind of think that the ability to give that space and deal with what is, Kelsey, I can't remember how you said it a few minutes ago, but deal in reality or something. I think that is a reflection of emotional health on the part of adoptive parents. So being raised by emotionally healthy parents is going to be better than being raised by people who are not able to deal with what's right in front of them, who deal in denial, who, like you said, Kelsey, kind of press things down or don't deal with them, deny they exist. I mean, those strategies can work for the short term, but not for the long-term health of people.
Yeah. I think like knowing your child, obviously, and having that deeper relationship with your child to know or be able to gauge when they're ready for certain conversations, but also giving them that open invitation to talk about things and kind of take the lead in that way.
Yeah. I want to talk about the pressing down too. And this is kind of answers another way of thinking of what you just asked me, Kelsey. But the pressing down that can happen that you just mentioned, Lori, that's when there's that frustration and those feelings go inward. And, you know, it's not a perfect study, but the study we have is that adoptees are 4 times more likely to attempt suicide than non-adoptees. And I would guess that a lot of that is because there's no room for that frustration and those feelings. And so all of the frustration and the attacking energy goes inward and it's to self-attack. And again, so that's the importance of like, how could we not do better just by making room and letting it come out, letting it get out instead of going back in.
The adoption competent therapist that I interviewed for my podcast, she talked about the shame core, that adoptees are born with the shame core. Maybe all humans are, but adoptees have it because of the trauma. And whenever they feel like they can't approach their adoptive parents about something, that reinforces their shame core because it's something they have to keep denying and hiding. And so healing the shame core is what adoption competent therapy should do. Adoption competent parents should do. But anything that reinforces the shame core is going to add to the grief and not do anything about healing.
Yeah. That's really an important point. And that's a great episode. So look for that episode to listen to it. And I will say one thing that you just made me think of, another little kind of point to make is, even it, the best adoptive parents with the biggest invitation, even if they do, sometimes adoptees feel we have to take care of our parents. And so it may not be that we don't, that the adoptive parents, they may be making a lot of space for that. But the adoptees may be just like, I don't want to hurt their feelings. And so it's that, and that's a trauma response because we've lost our first parents and we want to keep the next ones close. And so our brain has worked out that we've got to be, and not all of us again, but this was my experience. I've got to be good for, I've got to say the things that are needed here because I've got to keep my mom close in particular.
And the a good adoption competent therapist will work with the family, not just with the kid, and help the parents understand the things that they may be doing, the vibe that they may be sending, saying, you need to take care of my feelings on this. So it's a systems approach. That's one thing I would like people to know about adoption competent therapy. Somebody who's is actually competent about that is taking a systems approach to the relationships, not a person.
Love it. Yeah, so important. So important. Okay, Kelsey, can we come back to bereavement and birth parents? What you've worked in agencies, you've got so much experience in so many areas. So I'd love to just hear your thoughts on our birth mothers. And it sounds like they're not getting the support. And what are the reasons and complications? What's what's in there? Let's dig into that.
Yeah, it's a lot of things because, you know, I mean, no group of people is a monolith. So birth mothers are definitely not as well. And so what we see a lot of times is therapy is kind of a dirty word still, especially in low income communities. Therapy is kind of like, and it's also maybe not a dirty word in low income communities as much as it is not something that occurs in their circles. And so their friends and neighbors and family members aren't going to therapy. It's expensive. It typically requires health insurance, good health insurance, and something that a lot of people in this country go without. And so myself included, I have health insurance now, but for a long time I didn't. And I've never been able to continue going to therapy because I can't afford it. And so a lot of women also, after an adoption, they get therapy covered 3 to 6 sessions, and then that's it. And you can't begin to cover the traumas of adoption and anything that happened that led up to the adoption in 3 to 6 sessions. It just isn't possible. And I tend to see too with therapy, there's just a huge gap. The cyclical generational traumas that really have crippled our country so badly are like those populations are not finding therapy accessible to them. So that is a lot of birth moms' number one problem with finding help afterwards, the funding to continue, the insurance coverage to continue. And then secondary, I would say adoption competence. Finding an adoption competent therapist is one thing, but then finding one that includes birth parent relinquishment trauma in their adoption competence model is also really hard to find. It's not in every therapist's wheelhouse, and even like a grief and trauma therapist, they kind of look at relinquishment as like, yeah, it's traumatic, but I don't really know where to begin to talk to you about that. I've kind of seen confusion on the looks of a couple different therapists that I've started going to. And then, of course, if I can't afford to go and you're confused by what I'm telling you and you're not really understanding, then I see no reason to stretch my money as thin as I am to continue paying to see you when you don't have any. There's no healing that you're offering me or no understanding of my issues. And then third, I would say the problem is women are so embarrassed, humiliated, or shamed a lot of times from their adoption experience that they want to run the other direction and forget the whole thing. Of course, we know from the women that came before us that you never forget. But I think you know yourself really well until you do you make a choice that's impactful, and then all the rules go out the window and you don't know yourself at all. You're starting over with yourself. And so you want to go as far away from that experience as possible to try to find who you were before that it happened to you. You're never going to. Spoiler alert. But I think that it's such a heavy thing that most people aren't equipped to handle on their own. And they just don't know how to ask, if they can ask, or how that would even look for them to seek help. And I think that diversification of healing processes is so important, like whether you are going to therapy or a support group or a retreat or even an online group, which I don't always recommend, but I think sometimes it's our last hope, because some people live out in the middle of Montana and there's not a support group. There's not even a supermarket in the next hour from their town. So there's not a support group for birth parents. So I think that there's really great organizations like Lifetime Healing. They try to do support. Their goal is to do a support group in every 30 miles in the United States. Their support groups are awesome. I've been to them. Really helpful and healing, and such a great community aspect to them. On Your Feet Foundation has really great, like an online, like a Zoom support group that I think is once a month. And then they also have casework, post-placement casework, which is awesome to be able to have that, to have that social work assistance continue for you, so you don't feel like you've been totally left alone after placement. And not everybody benefits from therapy, as we stated before. I think I would if I could continue, but I think not everybody can do that. I also want to include the fact that a lot of Black women, women of color, aren't going to benefit from a white therapist when they're talking about what they've gone through. And so finding a therapist who is a Black woman or a woman of color, or, you know, is essential for them to find understanding. Just like I need understanding for certain aspects, they need that extra layer because they have an extra layer of complexity to their experience.
Yeah, thank you for saying that. And I also want to give a plug here for your podcast with Ashley Mitchell, from another mother. Wait, I've never said it out loud. because excellent resource as well.
Yeah, and that's called Twisted Sisterhood. Is that right, Kelsey?
Sorry. Yeah. Yes. That, from another mother, it's me on Instagram, and then Twisted Sisterhood is the podcast. Yeah.
Both excellent resources. Yes, thank you for that.
And I'm so glad you brought up the support groups, because those are, you know, for all the reasons you stated, access to therapy is maybe not going to work for everybody, but healing in community can also happen instead of healing in, you know, with a one-on-one. And those are some great support communities that you mentioned.
I wanted to quickly say to Laura or Kelsey that, that I really appreciated what you were just saying. And this is what's so beneficial about when the three of us talk, because, you know, so many adoptees experience secondary rejection when they go to seek their roots, to find their birth parents. And what you've said does explain that just kind of wanting to just run as far away, that it's not about us, the adoptees, as it can feel, but it's about just wanting to just pretend it didn't happen in that wounding.
And I think too, as part of that rejection and like what women like me have done to women like you or children like you would, even though you're an adult now, are children. I think part of preventing that is encouraging the post-placement support and healing early on. And from a professional standpoint, from a healthcare standpoint, I think each pit stop on the way through this process, for her to have constant reassurance that this is the process, this is normal, that what you're feeling, this is how we move forward with that. This is how a lot of women find healing and community and help. I think that is also part of the process of helping birth moms understand their role in this adoption too, that even if you want to run, even if all reflexes and instincts are telling you to run away from this traumatic experience, you have to stick around because you're not the child in this situation. You're not the one that's the center, and you have to play your part. And I think you have to heal in order to understand that.
Yeah, really good. Lori, over just back to the adoptive parent perspective, I am wondering, you've been in this space for so long, I know you, and the three of us have been talking for so long, but I don't know that most adoptive parents are aware that I think they might think that the agency gives more support than they do, or that where parents are ready to take advantage of, even if it's not beyond the, you know, even if it is just the three sessions, that's not enough. But I'm wondering if you could speak to that. And then I also would love to hear you speak to just, you mentioned the loss and the infertility for adoptive parents, which sometimes that's not grieved, and that has an effect on the way adoptees are parented, if we're kind of parented as the replacement child. And just, I would love to hear your thoughts on that. You're so wise on these things.
Yeah, and that goes back to the ghost kingdom, and whatever we don't deal with hangs around as a ghost. And so it behooves everybody to do the healing. You know, I was just thinking while Kelsey was speaking that though we all come to adoption on our knees, we don't have to stay on our knees. And healing does happen through community. So it doesn't have to be with one-on-one with a therapist, but in support groups. Agencies, I think, are doing a lot more because they're seeing the after effects now. They're starting to look at what's actually happening too. And I do see so many more agencies that are providing longer support for birth parents, programs like Big Tough Girl. Is that what she's calling it, Kelsey? Does she have another program name for that?
It's Lifetime Healing. Lifetime Healing. Foundation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the foundation. Offering coursework, offering contact with, putting together support groups. So I do think that there is a movement by lots and lots of vested people to try to do this better. We had the model that let's all just pretend it didn't happen. And we tried that for 50 years, something. And we know what happened after that. So now we're trying to figure out, so what would it look like if we actually acknowledged grief, if we actually started dealing with things earlier. And as you said, Sarah, we're in the early days of that. The children from this more open era, and by that I don't mean just contact, I mean actually doing the healing work, are just now probably coming of age. Maybe they're in the oldest ones are in their 20s. So I don't expect that it takes away all adoption issues at all. It just means that we're pacing ourselves and dealing with them as they come up, instead of saving them for that magic age of 18. When you can get your records, if you're in a state that you can get your records, or 30, when you have your own children, and that's when you want to search as an adoptee, or 60, when your adoptive parents die, and then you feel like you have permission to search. We don't have those markers anymore for adoptees. We're starting it on the day that they meet their new parents.
Yeah, really, really good, Lori. Thank you. Yes. Okay, well, I'm looking at the time, and we thought we knew we had a lot to say, and I think we probably still have more to say, but we'll pause there for now, unless either of you has anything else that we really do need to squeeze into this conversation. Anything else?
Okay. Leave us your comments and tell us what else you want to talk about.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for the conversation. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you in the next one.